One of the best things about the 21st century has been the variety of creative ways radio has evolved.
Really? That's one of the best things? It's not been the best century, then.
It's been slim. But the legacy of Marconi is in good hands with Alex Lefchik and the Midweek Drivettes. So we got that going for us.
Which is nice.
Now, you may have heard of Atlantis. You may have heard of Lemuria. You may have actually heard of the Bible. You may not have actually heard of the Thea Ubens. And certainly a fascinating text, which was first published at the last decade of the 20th century, has been creating waves in a variety of ways, in particular in China and in Taiwan. And we're delighted to be able to welcome the translator of this particular text to the program today to actually share some of his own thoughts and feelings with respect to this fascinating line, which is basically the Thea Uba prophecy, the golden planet, abduction to this golden planet. We're, of course, referring to Samuel Chong. How are you, Samuel?
Very good. Thank you for having me here.
Excellent. Now, the author, of course, of the abduction to the ninth planet, of course, is a French-Australian gentleman by the name of Michel Demarquet, I believe. Is that right?
That's correct. That's how we pronounce his name.
Well, we like to ensure that we Europeans have to stick together. That's the important thing. So in terms of that, though, I'm fascinated. How did you first connect with Michel yourself?
Yes. After I found this book, after I read it, I found the book to be very, very fascinating with specific verifiable details. And I was very amazed by the content of the book. In the postscript of the book, the author, Michel Demarquet, mentions that there are more incredible things that he was not allowed to write in the book, that we are far from understanding them. I was really curious about what he was referring to. So I was determined to find him, to locate him, and to ask him about it, the things that he was not allowed to write in the book. So I searched on the internet and tried to find where he was living at that time. And then after several tries, I located him and I found him.
And I mean, looking at the notes to the reader, he actually thanks publicly Janet Henderson, who edited the book, and respected absolutely word for word the true report that he had to write, which I thought was quite interesting, because, again, if I was being purely analytical from a sort of perspective, I'd say the number of times the single person I is actually used suggests that we have, from a psychological point of view, a very egotistical individual. But that's by the by. He may not be. And it's just an interesting line that the overuse of the first person singular kind of gives that impression. The text itself, though, is quite fascinating, but it kind of seems to kind of mix from a whole variety of aspects. I mean, on the one hand, he speaks highly about love. I mean, just to kind of summarize for the benefit of the listener who isn't aware of what this is about, it's about one individual's experience of a civilization which is infinitely more advanced than we are at Earth. It's at the ninth level of the cosmos. And it's basically their messages for the planets that he kind of is exposed to, because he's actually abducted to, as he says, the ninth planet. And I found that interesting, just from the point of view of one of the key messages is love, the importance of love, the importance of love for humanity and so on. And yet abduction, surely it's an antithesis when it comes to love. If you're abducted, it's hardly the loving action of, oh, I mean, we're into trafficking and all sorts of things of people who have been abducted. And that whole notion of alien abduction in particular, whether we talk about communion with Whitley Strieber, whether we talk about the huge range of certainly North Americans who claim to have actually experienced abduction, whether through viewing fictional episodes of The X-Files or other sort of areas, abduction and love don't seem to quite go together. Did you find that there was a bit of a disconnect from your own experience there?
Well, in my own experiences, I think the messages in the book are that we are at a very critical moment in the history of Earth, that we have to make a decision which path to go to. We are at a cross point in our future, I mean, determining our future. So we have to really, really focus on how we are going to evolve. And the messages from the ETs are really, really important, in the sense that such important message has to be conveyed to us in a very specific manner. And then they took him, and without his knowledge in the very beginning, was just to show that how important the messages are. I mean, I find that to be a necessary means to convey the messages to him. And I think it really justifies the importance of the message by taking him away without his consent in the beginning, but he enjoyed it afterwards. He really wanted to stay on that planet because it seems to him that the planet is a paradise to him.
Yes, I'm intrigued in terms of his line in the preface, which I imagine that to some extent this extraordinary story will appeal to some readers of science fiction, a story entirely invented, but I do not have the imagination that such a fabrication would require. This is not science fiction. And yet, there are so many similarities between the writings of Edgar Rice Burroughs and the John Carter of Mars series, where Mars is referred to as Old Barsoom, and John Carter is effectively moved up to a beam of light there. The Zenlar narratives of Adam Strange in terms of the graphic narratives of the 1960s and 1970s, where the Zeta beam actually transports Adam to, again, the planet Zenlar, and the line with respect to that, and many, many more. Now, there is, of course, the viewpoint that there is no such thing as fiction, that we live in a cosmos whereby the words that I'm speaking now are being written for me, and I'm simply articulating them as a cosmic puppet, if you like, and you're responding in like manner. And likewise, words that we write ourselves are creating some other species or dimensional reality. I mean, the multiphasic nature of the universe is something that cosmologists have spoken of. But I did find that possibly one of the interesting lines about this is that there's nothing really, in a sense, that's hyper new about what we see here. I mean, you could almost go back to the Bible itself and say the Bible is the basic instruction booklet for the life experience. You could look at the Buddhist philosophy of how we go around in many ways of reincarnations and aspects. And I know you talk about, well, not you, but actually the author talks about the whole notion of being reincarnated sometimes as human beings, sometimes as peasants, sometimes as royalty, sometimes as aliens, working through that whole process. Again, Mike Dooley, the works of Seth, There's a whole body of work which actually comes across in this sort of things, which if one was being absolutely critical of Michelle, you'd say, well, it's very derivative. And yet at the same time, is that simply because on some level, if we're talking about an archetypal level, and if we're talking about perhaps, as the psychoanalyst Jung would say, there is a cultural archetype here that actually means that this narrative is something which re-emerges regularly across different generations, across different times, as different civilizations encounter their own particular crises.
Yes, you are correct in a sense. This book is different in the sense that it contains a lot of verifiable details, specific verifiable details. It also explains a lot of the mysteries that occur on Earth. For example, who built the Great Pyramid of Egypt and for what purpose, and why there are so many planes and ships that went missing in the Bermuda Triangle. And what about the Bible? Is that like something that people distorted for the Bible in the Bible stories, or is it something like a true account of what really happened in history? It really gives some kind of evidence that we can go and look into it. For example, it mentions about there's a tomb of Jesus Christ in Shingo Village, Japan, that people can still visit. And why would that happen in Japan? Didn't Jesus die on the cross and resurrected after 3 days?
Well, not just Jesus, but his brother as well, which again, yes, I think is extraordinary in so many ways. And clearly on one level, a few hundred years ago, would have been deemed heresy. And actually, this conversation, we would both be effectively sentenced to execution immediately. That's why I was particularly interested so far as China has actually classified this as science fiction. Now, that interests me for two reasons. Firstly, because in the aftermath of the Cultural Revolution, science fiction was actually banned in China for about 30 to 40 years. And it wasn't really until the end of the 20th century, the beginning of the 21st century, that it was seen as a way of maybe providing the imagination, the imagineering to actually develop the sort of culture that was actually developed, that maybe science fiction could be seen as a useful thing. But it's not deemed a sort of fact. Even within China, it's kind of seen as, yeah, but it's science fiction, despite the author effectively saying, but it's not science fiction.
Right. It's very interesting that the publisher in China classified this book as a science fiction, and it was published that way. But still, like 70% of the readers in China believe that this is a true account of what happened to the author. So this really amazed me. A lot of people in China are really spiritual, and they really believe that this actually happened to the author. Mm-hmm. In Taiwan, on the other hand, it's published as a nonfiction, and in both places, it's been a bestseller. And this really makes the author and also myself very happy that people are opening up to their minds.
I mean, again, looking at the Hollywood narratives that come through here, you could almost say, as indeed was pointed out, a few alien believers would say that Steven Spielberg and Rod Serling and Gene Roddenberry were simply providing propaganda for extraterrestrials to effectively get us used to the idea of a close encounter of the third kind. An extraterrestrial, seeing alien beings as being somehow fellow life forms in this universe that we're traveling, as arguably spiritual beings on a human journey or human beings on a spiritual journey, whichever particular perspective you take on that. So is that something, again, which really that tendency to stand on the shoulders of giants, and you can go all the way back. I mean, you mentioned the Judeo-Christian tradition there. I mentioned obviously Buddhism, Islam. There are all manner of kind of earthly religions, which fundamentally they are all saying the same thing, which is what we started off with, which is treat other people with respect, treat people as you would wish to be treated yourself, and actually have that very Greek notion of philios, or sisterly, brotherly love for other human beings, not the sort of the erotic love, but the whole notion of love of one another. I mean, that is a kind of classic message. So is this, you mentioned it's very different. How is it very different from some of the other areas that we've heard of and have encountered in the past? Because I know I've spoken many a time to Mike Dooley, for instance, who writes The Universe Today and again has written Lost in Space, and again talks about how he also has had experiences channeling. And that's the other aspect, insofar as I find the notion of being abducted as opposed to simply channeling the information, which many people would say that's what they do. They open themselves up. It's what authors do. In a sense, that's part of the policy of whether you're writing fiction or an autobiography, etc. You're kind of allowing yourself to channel the words into action. And I'm just intrigued insofar as how this differs from the vast body of work that already exists over the few millennia. And admittedly, in the cosmic span of time, that's literally microseconds. So I'm well aware that, you know, what to us has been thousands and thousands of years, and we've gone through civilizations rising, civilizations falling. We've had arguably Atlantis. We've had the Greek civilization. We've had the Mayans. We were heavily involved about a decade ago with the end of the Mayan calendar and the notion of where that was taking us and how that was going. Or is this something whereby something, I mean, you said at the start, Samuel, that it's a time for now, this whole notion of an appropriate time. I am very tempted to use the Einstein quote, which I frequently use, that the only persistent illusion is that past, present, and future are separate entities. That actually, as we speak now, using what to many previous incarnations of civilization would be seen as magic. You know, here we are, different continents, separated over thousands of miles, having visual communication with each other, admittedly putting this out on a radio production, through a podcast, through people who could listen to it in all sorts of ways, would be deemed the stuff of either insane people or, you know, highfalutin, far-fetched imaginations. And I'm just intrigued insofar as how do we unpick that sort of package of saying, actually, what we've got here with Michel Desmarquez is something which is somehow different from that.
Yes, in the sense that he actually experienced it. He was taken away and then he was shown his previous 80 lives, how he behaved in his previous 80 lives and what he was, and also how he reacted to the challenges that he had. And he was, for example, he was a mining worker in Germany, and also he was a few times beggar on streets, and also he was a queen on another planet. So he was shown his previous lives. And then they say that life is actually similar to a wheel. Sometimes it goes up, sometimes it goes down. It's inevitable that you
classic
have to
Buddhist thought, isn't it?
Yes, very Buddhist thought. Yes. And also he actually personally experienced what happened on the continent of Lemuria, how the continent sunk into the ocean. And he actually was a witness on how people lived on the continent of Lemuria. They had no money, but they exchanged products and goods that they needed. So it was a very highly evolved civilization on this planet. Unfortunately, after it got sunk, its technologies got lost because they didn't really allow other civilizations to use their technologies. They kept the secrets to themselves. So this is very unfortunate that after Lemuria, Atlantis sunk, we actually went back to a more primitive stage of civilization. So this is what the main reason for the author to write this book is to show us that we can be as evolved as the other civilizations on Earth, such as the Atlantis or Lemuria. It's just that we have to be very conscientious about how we behave, how we react to the technologies that we have on Earth right now. And we have to be mindful of developing our spirituality and to follow a lot of the teachings of, for example, the Buddhist scriptures or the Bible or Jesus Christ. So this is actually the main message in the book.
And carrying on with that, when we look around the state of geopolitical situations at the world today, you mentioned obviously the book sold well in Taiwan and China. There's clearly tensions between China and Taiwan in terms of who owns which particular aspect of land is actually there and so on. We see the scenario in Ukraine. We see the Russian invasion there. We see lots of cases where if you were to actually evaluate the human condition as it is revealed to us here in the summer of the year Anno Domini 2022, you might sort of think, well, maybe it's time we just gave up, basically. Or is there an essential matter of hope in terms of that, that we can actually take from this? In other words, is there an intrinsic optimistic message that actually, I referred to Gene Roddenberry earlier, but that whole notion of the original incarnation of Star Trek, that actually humanity will survive and hopefully thrive into the 21st, 22nd, 23rd century and beyond? Or is it a case of, well, we don't know. We might as well just press the button now and end it all.
It really depends on how we act, how we react to the current situations. We have to get together to have concerted actions. The book is meant to open our eyes to see what is really going on around the world. For example, are the wars created only by the politicians, or is it something behind it, someone running behind the scenes? We really have to open it up and to be mindful about what's really going on, who benefits from the wars. Is it the politicians or is it the military industrial complex? We have to really know what's the truth. We have to find out the truth ourselves, and then we have to act together. The book actually gives a solution, which is the non-violent resistance that Gandhi did in India, which is really, really a good solution in my mind. Because when you think about it, we, the poor people, we lose little when we start a strike. But the rich, the wealthy, the group of financiers, they lose the most, they lose big, because no one will work for them. And if we have concerted actions, if we get our acts together to resist in a non-violent way, we are going to be successful. It actually gives a very interesting example to illustrate this. It happened on another planet in which a country had a lot of wars, a lot of dictatorship, authoritarian regimes, and they started with four people who preached love and spirituality. And then the authoritarian government killed the four people. And a few months later, people became aware of it and people acted together and started a strike. And that country actually became the most successful and spiritual country on that planet. So this is a very interesting example how our people on Earth can get our acts together. And our future really depends on us, how we react, how we act together.
One of the common grounds that I think most astronauts have come back with is this notion of a worldview. And even those people like William Shatner, who was literally just up in space very shortly for a few moments, you have this sense that once perceived from outside the atmosphere, this fragile green and blue marble that we effectively exist on, that we're actually working through, that it does relate to the position of humanity. And I say humanity deliberately. I don't want to get into genders here, because clearly there are apparently 63 genders that are actually around in terms of the Ter Ubans. They're mostly hermaphrodites, so they should be referred to as they if we're looking at pronouns and so on. But if we're looking at that sense of immensity that we also see revealed to us through the recent images from the James Webb Space Telescope, where you look at some of those fantastic images that come across that show us just how huge and immense the cosmos is. You don't even have to actually see you can just look up at a night sky, and if you don't have light pollution there, you see a sense of the immensity of the universe. Does it not often is it not an act of hubris to think that on some level we as humans deserve to actually be doing fantastic things and working through that, or is it a case of balance?
Well, if you look at the universe, and according to the book, we people on Earth live on Category 1 planet, which is the lowest level of categories. And
it's a kindergarten, let's face it.
Yes. And there's nothing to be ashamed being a person in the kindergarten. And we have to learn the basic fundamentals of the things in life. And there's nothing to worry too much about it. And we just have to go step by step and to progress and move up the ladder. And we really have to be a good student to learn how to live on this planet in a peaceful manner, and to love one another, and to give other unconditional love, and to really behave well in the universe so that we can be ready and to move up.
So those baby steps that we hear so much about in terms of many spiritual gurus and teachers, whether we're talking about James Redfield and the Celestine Prophecy, whether we're talking about other writers in terms of the field, the line that we have to work through, they are important. If we also look at the other side, because you mentioned that obviously the global notion. Now, clearly, there are an awful lot of conspiracy theorists, we'll use the brand, who will actually argue that Davos is the Bilderberg group, the 12 families. There are a group of organizations who, if you follow the money, that line that you actually got, certainly in the pandemic, which I know carried a certain traction with it, about in the future, you will owe nothing and you'll be happy, carried with it a whole range of issues in terms of where do the rights of the individual, or where do individuals in general have any place in a future in which effectively everything is predetermined, almost like the genetic code, that we're born, we live, we die, we go on an endless treadmill. Is there a sense of that, let's use the Buddhist term, enlightenment, elucidation, that whole notion of where we can actually recognize our own reality? Or is it just a case of ultimately that Buddhist sense of we need to acknowledge the oneness in everything? We need to acknowledge that namaste, the very profound greeting that effectively translates as we recognize the divinity in other people as much as they recognize the divinity in ourselves, that that is at the essential heart of what we should be doing. And somehow that gets really confused. I mean, I'm tempted to cite Einstein again. And once, I mean, Albert Einstein, who I'd say was fairly enlightened, but his line about a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, so is a lot. You know, these are the kind of areas where sometimes we tend to think it's always somebody else's fault. I mean, we haven't even spoken about other intelligences on the planet Earth, the dolphin, the whale, the other species we actually spend time with, etc. You know, in some ways, maybe we just lose touch, we just disconnect. We have this sort of human-centric sort of view that somehow we just don't know what we do. We're stumbling along there.
Yes, the notion of predetermination is one of the concepts in this book. Is that we do have like a factor of predetermination, which is in the sense that it's affected our free will. We have our own like determination on which way to go, and part of it is printed in our life before. But we see how we are going to live before we kind of go into the womb of the mother, and we preview our lifetime. So that's kind of a predetermined. But at the same time, we also have the free will. We can change our directions in life and move to the more spiritual way, a more materialistic way. And also this book is also very interesting in the sense that also as another factor, which is the accidental factor, it mentions that in the universe, there's basically 19% of chances that accidents occur. So it's a very interesting notion that you have the predetermination factor, you have the free will factor, you also have the accident factor. So it's a very, very interesting evolvement that things can go into a very interesting directions. So I think this is something unique about this book. It combines all the three factors together.
Nature and nurture, perhaps. Yes. Samuel, let's turn to yourself for a few moments. I mean, you're a certified court interpreter. You're a Chinese translator in Los Angeles. Clearly, we've shared the sort of role of how you got involved with this particular aspect. What's your own life journey and why Los Angeles as opposed to Green Bluff, Illinois, or Des Moines, Iowa, or any of those areas, or Lincoln, England? Which ones would you share with us how effectively your own path took you into the role of interpreting?
Yes, I was born in Beijing, China, and came to the United States at the age of 15 in 1993. And then I studied at UC Berkeley. I went to LSE, London School of Economics, for about a year, studying the general course program over there. And I got my master's degree from a university in Spain in financial analysis. I wanted to make a lot of money, to earn a lot of money by playing the financial markets. I also wanted to become a doctor because in the late 90s, doctors in the US earned a lot of money. So I was really, really materialistic, you know, in a sense, in a way, and wanted to make a very good living. But then the course of life turned me into becoming a paralegal at a law firm and becoming a Chinese tutor, teaching people how to study Chinese. And then accidentally, I got into the translation interpretation field. I found that to be very rewarding because I get a chance to interact and to work for different industries. I also speak some Spanish, and I also found out that Los Angeles is an ideal place to live because it is a mix of Asian culture and Latin American culture, and also American culture too. So I can really interact with people from different backgrounds. In addition to London, I love London too, because I met a lot of people from Africa, from Europe, which I didn't have the chance. I haven't got a chance in the US yet. So I think in the future, my main goal is to wake people up and to let them become aware about the current situations, whether it's political or health-wise. Because when you look at a pandemic, a lot of strange things happen. For example, licensed doctors in the United States cannot voice their opinions out on certain issues. Their YouTube videos got removed and their Twitter accounts got suspended. So those are licensed medical doctors in the United States, and they cannot voice themselves out. So who can? What's really going on behind the scenes? Who controls media? So I think, for what purposes? Why did the Georgia Guidestones disappear, or maybe got distracted? Why were they built in the first place? So I think a lot of interesting things happen around the world, and people really need to investigate and to find out what is really going on.
I mean, again, you raise a number of really interesting points there, which certainly the Chris Carter series, The X-Files, started playing about with in the 1990s. And again, many folk would actually have this notion of, well, that's fascinating. Is there something also that's in the human nature of somehow we forget Occam's razor? I mean, William of Occam, who often said that when all things are considered, the simplest solution is the more likely. That's certainly the more likely of the key things that we actually look for in terms of working through that. And do we sometimes actually neglect that by wanting to actually dress around the narrative, the drama? I mean, we as human beings, we love the drama. You know, we like that sense of drama and the fact that we can obviously abdicate responsibilities and actually go to another zone, etc. Is there something here that actually we just need to maybe take a step back and say, well, maybe, to use a classic British term, the cock-up theory rather than conspiracy theory is more appropriate?
Well, you know, I didn't believe in the conspiracy theories in the past. I really didn't, because I thought those are just people who wanted to make a living out of it. But I accidentally found another book, which I translated, which is the 334 Thousands Lies. It was originally written in German. I found the book because I was looking for ways to read or to be able to see the human energy field, the auras. And I found that book and I translated it into English, and I found that to be very interesting, because it's supposedly to be an autobiography of the highest chair of a secret society that started in Germany. Is very interesting because it corroborates, it really relates to the accounts of Ronald Bernard, a Dutch banker who used to work for the people from the Illuminati. And when you see that two stories that have no relation to each other match, it tells you something. So it makes me think that if there's really something something that's kind of makes people really want to do more research on that area. I'm not saying that Illuminati exists or it doesn't exist. It's just that it's worth finding out more about it. It's worth people to open themselves up and to have an open mind about it.
You shared with us some of your own life journey. If the opportunity arose, which you could well do in your lifetime, of actually going up into space yourself, going on to the moon and possibly beyond, would you actually opt for that? Or would you say, no, I'm going to stay on the planet Earth?
I would stay on planet Earth for a very good reason, because I know about what it's like on Earth. There's because if you read the book, The Oba Prophecy, you're going to know that there is indeed an alien base on the far side of the moon. And if you read the book, you're going to know that there was life on Mars 300,000 years ago.
And we may well be the Martians, Samuel. We may actually be distantly evolved from bacteria that effectively came from Mars across the whole thing. And ultimately, the one apparently unassailable fact is that we are all star stuff. We're all made out of the creatures, the hydrogen atoms that several billion years ago went to actually form the stars, the planets, and so on, and maybe gave us a sort of variety of life as well, which perhaps we should thank the universe for and be grateful. Samuel, it's been fascinating just getting a little flavour, and that's all we've really had time to do, even though we've spent over 1,900 seconds actually just discussing the actual text. The Tea Uba Prophecy, of course, Abduction to the Ninth Planet, written by Michel Demarquet. It is available online. You can get it through usual sort of book sources and so on. We're going to finish with two final questions, of course. First of all, Samuel Chong, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today?
Very interesting Zoomer.
I'm using that to define the conversation we've actually had, because it's not a telephone call. We've had visual connections, so we use the term Zoomer. Have you enjoyed it?
Yes, very much, very much so. It's fascinating and very philosophical.
Well, thank you. So the next particular question is, can we prevail upon you to return in the not too distant future and maybe join us again for some more Tea Uba thoughts and various other things? Will you be kind enough to return sometime?
Yes, definitely. Yes, my pleasure.
Fantastic. Actually, Samuel, one thing I will actually ask you, we often in our author features or translating author features have a musical slot. Do you have any particular piece of music or any particular element that you'd like us to try and add to this particular piece? Any particular artist or musician that you think, yes, you should go for that?
I don't have any specific preference. And I think any music that you think is appropriate will be good.
Perhaps some Jean-Michel Jarre. I was thinking originally Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, but maybe not. Let's go for Jean-Michel Jarre and maybe Oxygen.
Yeah, sure. Anything that you think is appropriate.
rather dating game, something that continually kind of percolates through the whole human experience over the years. But what about actually getting the right partner, that harmonious connection, which actually sort of leads to Mr. or Miss right, wrong, and so on and so forth. Apparently in the East Midlands, almost half of people actually avoid dating people who don't tick their romantic boxes, with one in five people actually admitting that they're in a long-term relationship with somebody who isn't their type. So maybe a bit of contradiction there. Anyway, the only person we could really go to actually discuss in detail some of these aspects is, of course, dating expert from eHarmony, the legendary Rachel Lloyd. How are you, Rachel?
Hello, really good to talk.
Always good to connect with your good self. And interesting that these findings that suggest that maybe those preconceived ideas about, well, they must have this, they must do that, etc. Maybe we need to actually think again, perhaps.
Yeah, completely. I mean, the reason we did this study at eHarmony is because we wanted to look at the fact that people often set their filters on dating apps to be very prescriptive and quite narrow. And we think they're missing out on meeting all sorts of lovely people who could really be suitable for them. So as you say, in the East Midlands, half of people are saying, oh no, I avoid dating people who aren't my romantic type. But one in five are actually in a relationship which is long-term with someone who isn't their traditional type. So I think this demonstrates we can all afford to be a bit more relaxed about our shopping list of requirements for love.
Well, there is, of course, that aspect that if you actually are so prescriptive, you end up actually sort of saying, well, no, it's just not going to work in any way, shape or form. And I was intrigued by the dating deal breakers that came through, that certain issues such as a new love interest being overweight, not making them laugh or being the wrong age for them, they're all deal breakers in terms of the way forward, which, again, maybe it is a case of we need to actually, in the words of the classic greeting, namaste, recognize the divine in all of us.
Indeed. We need to really watch those deal breakers. As you say, age, someone being overweight, someone not being funny enough. These are the things that come up. And weirdly enough, well, perhaps not weirdly, but in a very modern sense, people lose votes if they're considered too woke or they're an anti-vaxxer. But I would say that this is about finding someone that shares your values and is on the same page as you, because whoever you are, whatever your values are, as long as you go for someone similar, you're likely to have a great relationship.
Yeah, I was intrigued by the 19% who said that they wouldn't consider, or they wouldn't date anybody that they consider to be too woke, because presumably if somebody was sufficiently woke, you would actually avoid a patriarchal system like a dating agency in any way, shape or form, wouldn't you?
Oh, nice one. Yes, well, I don't know. I mean, woke is very subjective. What do we call woke? There's extreme woke and mildly woke. But I do think that we throw these labels around and they're sometimes a little bit crude and unfair. Woke might just be someone who's sensitive and has quite liberal values. So let's keep an open mind there. We also found, funnily, in this kind of context, after, you know, the dreaded Brexit referendum, whichever side of that you were on, let's agree it was quite a difficult time politically. We found that 1.6 million relationships spontaneously combusted because couples within that relationship had different views on whether to stay or leave the EU. So we know that politics and political ideologies, like being super woke, can have an impact on dating suitability. So it's worth bearing in mind.
Yes, I was reminded of the Jonathan Swift description in Gulliver's Travels of a country that effectively had gone to war with itself because of the egg, and whether you should actually eat your hard-boiled egg from the top or from the bottom, really, which is a kind of similar thing, really. Likewise, I suppose if you negate all anti-vaxxers, you could be turning down a potentially a premiership footballer. But there we are. Yeah. That's a different line.
That's a really good way of looking at it.
Is it a case, of course, where we look for other stereotypes that the mainstream media has maybe produced over the years, that maybe also gentlemen don't prefer blondes, and that actually a brunette is deemed to be more appropriate as opposed to necessarily being blonde?
Yes, exactly. I wanted to look at the stereotypes, and what we found was that dark-haired ladies are more appealing than blondes. So they get 47% prefer to date brunettes, and just 25% of men prefer to date blondes. So this goes against everything we've been told about blondes have more fun, blondes are more attractive. I mean, of course, this is only a survey. In reality, I think people do date different types of, you know, hair color, hopefully. But it does show that some of these stereotypes are not necessarily what they seem. And the same comes, you know, when we talk about one of the deal breakers was people don't want to date someone who's too old. Well, that depends what age you are. It's, again, subjective. But what we already know at eHarmony is that typically men will date a woman that's 18 months to 2 years younger. And women are the opposite. They prefer to date a guy that's a year or two older. However, if they're parents, then that age bias disappears. So for mums and dads, they forget about age. They're much more open-minded and they're just looking for someone with family values. So, you know, bear in mind that all of these statistics are interesting and they give us some leverage on what's going on out there, but they're just like taking a reading. Reality is often far more interesting.
Yeah, I was quite encouraged by the fact that trustworthiness is the number one desired trait for both genders. I mean, ultimately, any relationship that's going to actually withstand the test of time, you need to have a certain amount of trust. In fact, total trust, really, to actually ensure that you get through those difficulties, I would have thought.
Yeah, followed by kindness and a sense of humour. And we know that sense of humour is a really big aphrodisiac, so we're not surprised by that one. But trust is obviously the bedrock of any long-term relationship that's based on monogamy. And it's slightly more important to women, actually, we found, than men. But nevertheless, it's important. So that's good to see.
And whilst we were talking about blondes or brunettes, et cetera, we'd also say for hot, follically challenged individuals, don't worry, I'm sure there's somebody out there as well. It's very important. Let's wrap up by basically saying, where do people go to find out the survey? Would it be eharmony.co.uk, Rachel?
How did you know?
Spooky, isn't it, really? Critically then, two final questions. Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the programme today, being number one?
I've loved it, but I'm just thinking about dyeing my hair because I'm blonde.
Oh, Rachel, you'd be absolutely spot on. It's the inner self, the inner divine.
Values that count. I agree. Precisely. I've had a lovely time. Thank you.
So the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to join us again in the not too distant future? Will you be kind enough to return sometime?
Absolutely. I'm all yours.
Above lying here, there's so many things I wanna say. I will always love you,
Well, it's a fact of life, unfortunately. The cost of living crisis is impacting people across the board. And a recent research from the National Poverty Charity Turn to Us has revealed almost half of the people that come to them for help do so after being left with nothing to live on each week after paying housing, council tax and utility bills. So to address some of the challenges that occur when you're literally having to exist on the breadline, we're pleased to actually welcome the head of information programs at Turn to Us. That's Michael Clark. How are you, Michael?
I'm very well, thank you.
And also a senior welfare benefits specialist, Anna Stevenson. How are you, Anna?
Good morning.
Anna, if we come to you first, because this is really a frightening survey in terms of how people are literally just having to barely survive. So, I mean, were you surprised by the findings, or was it just a case of actually, you know, this is what we have to expect given the perfect storm of fuel costs, housing, all the rest of the stuff that's actually on board?
Yeah, I mean, the important thing to remember is that over the past 10 years, the financial resilience of low-income households has been eroded and eroded away. And so as we've hit this crisis, people have no resources left to manage it, to address it. And so that's what we're seeing here, that each time something goes wrong, it becomes an enormous crisis for people on the lowest incomes.
Michael, you've previously worked in senior digital content and service roles for ASMA UK, the University of London, commercial digital agencies, and so on. But let's talk about Turn to Us, which is the focus of this particular piece. What do Turn to Us actually offer when somebody actually reaches the stage of they need your help?
I think the core thing that we ask people to do is get a benefit calculation. We reckon there's about 15 billion, there are different stats out there, but it's around that amount of benefits that go unclaimed. We really strongly recommend that people go online, do a benefits calculation and find out everything that they are actually entitled to. People really could be surprised at what they are not actually claiming. Once they've done that, it's also worthwhile doing a grant check. A lot of people are tipped into financial crisis because of a big one-off cost that hits them, a broken down washing machine or a cooker which has stopped working. We have a database of 1,600 grants on a tool called Grant Search, which are all from charities who give money to individuals. Now, the coverage is not perfect, but it's always worth going through and searching what might be available for you on in that particular situation, especially if you're facing some sort of one-off emergency. We also have a database which supports people in finding more specialized advice in their locality. I think that's particularly important that people maybe go on there and look if they have a particular issue to do with housing or something more specialised. There are lots of things where we can't offer direct support with, but it is actually out there.
One of the criticisms, of course, is that there's so many details that are possibly out there, but actually tracking them down and finding them is a challenge. I mean, Anna, clearly what we're doing today is to hopefully raise the awareness of organisations like Turn to Us. But again, getting the message out there, is that still proving a challenge?
It can be really difficult for people to work out what help they're entitled to. The benefit system is quite complicated. There's lots of different bits of help that are quite scattered. And at times when people are feeling stressed and overwhelmed, the idea of needing to spend a whole lot of time searching out all this help, it can just feel overwhelming. But the important thing to remember is that you can take control of things to some extent. So you can sit down, make sure you're getting everything you're entitled to. It feels stressful to begin with, but it's actually pretty easy to do. So if you are feeling like you're struggling, it's a really good idea to just spend a bit of time sitting down, going over your budget, going through the tools we have on our website, turntous.org.uk, and just seeing what extra help you could be getting.
Now, we've also got, of course, as part of this particular piece, the How Many More campaign. Michael, would you actually just talk to us about the How Many More campaign and how it's designed to actually urge people across the country to effectively campaign for long-term change and hopefully make organisations like Turn to Us not as essential as they are proving to be?
That's right. One of the actual challenges, we can go on pushing people to pointing people at help they can actually get. We can ask them to do benefit calculations. But the other side of it is that there need to be, I think, changes made to improve the system. Benefits aren't adequate for people to live a dignified life on, to support their families, whether they're people who are looking for work, yeah, or whether they're people claiming benefits who are already in work. And it's always worth remembering that about 43% of people who are claiming universal credit are people who are working, but they're not earning enough to be able to manage the bills they actually have. So we want to see major changes in this.
And Anna, I know you're passionate about ensuring financial security for all people. Clearly, there is a vacancy in 10 Downing Street, and we don't know what's going to pan out as far as that's concerned in the next few months. But what would you actually encourage the government to do to actually help those who are quite literally struggling to put food on the table?
We want to see the government take some immediate steps to help people now, but we also want to see the government take steps to make sure that rather than lurch from crisis to crisis, patching things up as we go, we have a system which supports long-term economic thriving for everyone. So we want to see benefits increased in line with inflation, and we want to see an additional uplift to meet the cost of living. We want to see the government investing long-term in crisis support to help councils respond quickly when there's severe need in their area. And we want them right now, as an emergency, to stop the unaffordable rates of universal credit deductions for advances and debts, because this is just pushing people into debt at a time when they cannot afford it.
Yeah. And obviously, you use the term right now. I mean, Michael, is that a realistic aim in terms of can the government do that? Or is it a case of, well, we're still in hiatus?
I think it's realistic if there's a will to do it. We may still be in hiatus, but last time I looked, we still had, for whatever purpose, a prime minister there. We still have a cabinet. We still have a government which is, you know, in office and being paid to act. So I don't think there's anything other than the will to do it, which is actually in the way.